Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Story time.
I worked as a ranger in Northern Carolina for well over 20 years. I've had my fair share of weird happenings and some gruesome ones too. I found multiple dead bodies during my time working there. All of the killers were luckily brought to justice by the police, but it's not the killings that got me to quit my job and never come back. It was something a little more unexplainable, something so weird, in fact, that I sometimes still wonder if it was all just a dream or vision or indeed a real event. I'll tell you exactly what I saw from the beginning. It was the middle of August, and the sun was scorching the ground with its rays. Not many people visited during the day for obvious reasons. I hated when I had to leave my guard hut to make a tour of the park, that would usually include a lot of sweating and feeling like somebody is roasting you in a pan. I was already pretty beat during my first 2 hours, drinking more than enough water to try and keep hydrated. As it was already time to go out for the third and final tour of the day because for the next shift another ranger was going to replace me, I went on a walk. About halfway through, I started feeling dizzy and a little lost. I felt weaker and weaker up until I could not stand anymore. I sat under a nearby tree to try and get some rest and regain strength, but the sun and heat were too strong. I began seeing things and just felt a little too real. The tall shadowy figures began emerging from behind trees, walking slowly and aimlessly. I couldn't move or breathe properly, so I just sat there staring back at them. In a minute, there were so many of them, I lost count, and more began emerging straight from the ground. I was confident that I had had a severe sunstroke. They didn't seem to pay any attention to me at first, they just wandered around and let out horrific screams of pain, like somebody being cooked alive. Just then, one of those figures had noticed me, slowly making its way. It was over 8 feet tall, so it had to crouch down to get close to me. I was petrified, but I didn't possess the strength to do anything. The figure didn't stop screaming for a split second either, it just crouched next to me and put its hand on my cheek. I started to burn, and I lost consciousness. Other rangers found me passed out on the ground about an hour later, getting me to an ambulance. I was relieved for a minute, but when I got up from the bed, I saw that red burning handprint. It terrified me so much I had to resign. None of my bosses or colleagues ever believed me. I guess I can't say I blame them. Not a park ranger, but I alerted the park rangers after I was going to use one of those little restroom huts you use prior to a hike after seeing a bloody scene in there. Basically, I went to grab the handle to the restroom and the door abruptly swung open and a younger girl swiftly limped out, dragging one leg as she hurried away. I immediately looked inside the bathroom and it was covered in blood, feces and urine. I mean covered. Blood was smeared everywhere and even dripping from the ceiling. Feces mixed with blood was flung about and the stench was unreal. The blood loss must have resulted from significant injury as it was pooled all on the floor. I stumbled backwards and tried not to vomit. I alerted the ranger and they said they would try to locate the girl. From what I could tell, she had no blood on her that I could see, but why was she in there? There's no way she didn't notice that before entering, as the smell alone knocked you back. I still wonder if she caused that scene. Was she giving birth and disposing of the baby in there? The restroom had one of those toilets where it's like a big tunnel that goes way down, kinda like a huge porta potty. I wonder if she had the idea to give birth in there and dispose of the baby afterwards because it was a very remote area. Or was she injured somehow? But she looked started to see another person and ran away. It still haunts me. My dad worked in forestry and has many stories, but one of them stands out. He received a call about a fire or was just supposed to go check something out. Upon arrival, he saw a car on fire. He was trying to check if there was a person, not this time. A guy started shooting at him. And with a car on fire in the neck of the woods, he started running. The guy he was working with asked him why he was running, and he told him to go see for yourself. When the guy returned running, they decided to leave it be. Other times, he stumbled upon moonshine operations and instances of insurance fraud involving the burning of cars. So, I've been talking about these stories to some of y'all for a while. And have finally been able to meet with my dad face to face to hear these stories from him again. And confirm some details. As we talked, we both kind of noticed how the tradition of storytelling has changed over the years. Before the internet, my grandpa told my dad stories, who in turn told me stories. These stories left deep impressions on me, which is why campfire scary stories is probably one of my favorite genres of storytelling. Now over text, I can't relay the same inflections and cadence of my dad's voice, and I can't mimic the gestures he uses to illustrate a point. I really wish I could. So I did my best to capture these old stories in writing. I always tell them around campfires, but hopefully I can immortalize them here for others to read and share as well. Grandpa's Border Patrol Stories. I had heard stories about my grandpa ever since I was a kid. He was my dad's dad and had experienced a lot in life. And this in turn generated some of the most amazing stories I had heard in my childhood. After the Korean War, he became a law enforcement officer in Lubbock, Texas in the late 50s, being the first Hispanic to be employed in the Texas civil service system there, and then from 1960-67 he served as a Texas Border Patrol agent, becoming one of the first of five Hispanics to be employed by that agency, up to that time. He later worked for the U.S. Customs Agency Service, and the DEA in the 70s. My dad always told me some amazing stories, and not all of them fit here, and some are not for me to share, but he has two that, although did not happen to him, have been told to my dad, who later told them to me, in pretty good detail. So the next two stories take place between 1960 and 1967. My dad's family was living in the southwest Texas town of Eagle Pass, which is a border town that borders the Mexican city of Piedras Negras. My grandpa was doing border patrol work there and in the nearby border towns that are scattered along the Rio Grande River. The sand trap. Now, before I get into this first story, I have to explain what a sand trap is. It's not necessarily a trap exactly. There are some spots along the Rio Grande that are low enough to cross over without much effort. These areas are patrolled but can't be monitored 24/7, especially back then, so sometimes immigrants pass through without detection. In places where the brush wasn't too thick, they would throw down layers of sand and smooth it out. This allowed them to monitor and count footprints and track who or how many people were crossing the river and into the U.S. My grandpa worked the morning shift and arrived at the station to supposedly catch up on paperwork and get some coffee. That's where he found the late night officer, who I'll refer to as Mr. L, at the station back from his post earlier than he should have. He was pale and looking very distraught. Grandpa asked Mr. L what his deal was and was told the following story. Mr. L had been hearing rumors of some creepy post out in Del Rio, a town about an hour north of Eagle Pass. Essentially, there was a low point in the river where immigrants would cross and enter private ranch land. Multiple BP agents would be sent to check the sand trap there to see if anything was turning up, but they never got any footprints. They needed someone out there to monitor it more closely, however, nobody wanted to stay after dusk. The area was rumored to be unsettling and quite possibly haunted. Mr. L thought that was a crock of shit. My dad describes Mr. L as a very tall man, shaved head, and very tough. The kind of person that doesn't take any bullshit. He decided that he would go out there himself at night and show these other guys that they're just being a bunch of sissies. He drives to the Del Rio station and starts getting ready. A lot of the guys were telling him to not worry about it, they can just check the trap in the morning for footprints, and showed obvious signs of concern, but of course he brushed it off and was handed a large ring of keys. The keys were to unlock the multiple ranch gates in the county, as he would be driving deep into the middle of nowhere and through multiple properties. He got in his service vehicle, made sure he had all the supplies he needed, and took off down the old county road and then would later turn off to a gated ranch road. It took him over an hour of passing through multiple gates and driving unkempt dirt roads just to get to the spot. He left in the late afternoon, and by the time he arrived at the post, dusk was just upon him. He said the spot was loaded with mesquite, creosote and all sorts of brush. You couldn't walk through the brush unless you had a bush hog tractor clear the place out. There was, however, a small, worn path leading from the river that you could get through just barely. This is where the sand trap was placed, since it served as a choke point for any foot traffic. Of course, the trap is devoid of any footprints, so he settles down and waits for nightfall. The night was pretty uneventful. The moon was out and lit up the area in a dim, ethereal light. The air was still, and despite being out in the middle of nowhere in Texas, there weren't many of the usual night sounds he was accustomed to. He says he would have fallen asleep, but the lack of sound kept him on edge and made him unnecessarily anxious. At around 3 or 4 a.m., he was getting the feeling that maybe this spot wasn't so bad after all, and his anxiety was from him just hearing rumors. Then he heard the faint sound of footsteps. He put out his cigarette and tightened his grip on his .357 Magnum sidearm. The sound of brush being pushed away and footsteps got closer. The moon was lower now and it was very dark, but he could see the silhouettes of three men come into view. They emerged from the brush, but something was off about their appearance. He thought maybe it was the lack of light, but their silhouettes were pitch black. It was dark, but these forms looked like they were darker than night. Their eyes were glowing, similar to how a cat's would if you shined a light at their face in the dark. He called out to them, but they kept moving, ignoring his commands to freeze. They walk in single file, slowly ambling along the path. He points his vehicle's spotlight at them and feels his blood run cold. The forms look like shadows cast on a wall in a puppet show. He said it looked like someone was walking in front of his spotlight, But the shadows that were cast were disembodied and didn't belong to anything. He stood in awe and fear for probably 45 minutes. The forms were gone and there was no longer any sound coming from the brush. He went down to check the sand trap, and found that it was still smooth, and it was like nobody had ever crossed that area. He suddenly felt dreadful, and as though something was watching him. The feeling wouldn't go away and he started to feel fearful. He got in his vehicle and left. He drove straight to Eagle Pass and since my grandpa came in early, he heard everything from the now shaken Mr. L. My grandpa didn't have a fun time as Mr. L didn't bother to lock the numerous ranch gates behind him. I wish I could say this is the fun part of the story where my grandpa goes over there to close it for him and see the spot for himself, but he had stuff to do and delivered the keys back to the Del Rio station and let them take care of it. Mr. L never went back to that area, but he stopped making fun of his fellow colleagues' stories. Funnily enough, not much changed about him. He wasn't scared of anything, and was a mean guy all around. But whenever Mr. L retold the story at later times, my dad could tell that it was an event that really shook him. My grandpa continued to hear stories about that remote Del Rio post, but over time he heard less about it as he was given assignments that took him away from that town. He believes it was haunted and people said it was an evil place, and although they never caught anybody in that area in his 7 years as a border patrol agent, there surely was something crossing over. The horseback rider. This is another one that didn't happen to my grandpa but was told by his colleague as they were exchanging stories one morning at the station. His colleague, who we will call Angus, was another one of those true Texan no bullshit types. He graduated from Texas A&M University, was a bona fide cowboy, and had worked as a ranch hand for years before coming onto the Texas Border Patrol. He would patrol ranches and other properties near the border on horseback, and would monitor sand traps and look for anything or anyone suspicious. This one instance took place near Rio Grande City. He was on horseback in the middle of nowhere on a ranch in Starr County, Texas. The sun was hot, and he hadn't come across anything or anybody for hours. He was miles away from any service road, much less a county road, and he started to get thirsty. He took a quick break to drink some water and get his horse hydrated, too. He wiped the sweat off his brow when maybe 500 feet away, he saw a figure moving across the plains at a decent pace. He took a sip out of his canteen and got his binoculars out. He could see it was an older man, with a cowboy hat riding a horse at a slight trot. Angus closed his canteen and put his binoculars back around his neck. He radioed in the incident and mounted his horse and took off after the person, hoping to intercept him. He started off with his horse at a full gallop, kicking up dust behind him. The area was hilly and he passed a bend and saw that the rider was now further away than he was before. Confused but determined, Angus drove his spurs into the side of his horse to goad it into going faster. They started to gain ground on the other rider. He disappeared around another bend but Angus was close behind. When Angus came around the bend, he saw that the rider was even further away. Angus started to get pissed off. Obviously the guy was messing with him and he was ready to apprehend him. He gets his horse to go even faster. His hat was barely hanging on, and everything was shaking and starting to come loose from their holsters and bags. He gained on the figure yet again, but after another bend, the figure came even further away. He had never made his horse go this fast. Its grunts were harsh and labored. After each bend, the figure got further and further away, until it finally disappeared. For fear of his horse's safety, he decided to call off the pursuit and radio in that the suspect had got away. He dismounted and gave his horse some water. They had probably traveled about 5 to 10 miles from where they originally spotted the lone horseback rider. He decided to double back. He started to notice that the only tracks were his own. No other tracks but the ones from his horse were found the whole way back. He told everyone on the McAllen horseback unit about it, and asked them if they ever experienced anything like it, but not one of them believed him. Said it was just a mirage, or he had heat stroke. Angus assured them that he knew the signs of heat stroke and his limits. He had been a ranch hand for years, after all. He wouldn't have continued if he knew he was not well enough to do so. He let it go for a little while but told my grandpa eventually when he did some work in Eagle Pass. He never seemed scared about it, but perplexed. He continued working in that area of Star County, but he never experienced anything like that ever again. My dad's stories. There's not that much more information I really need to give on my dad other than he grew up in a completely different lifestyle than I did. I grew up in basically suburbia on a cul-de-sac and lived in a city, whereas his family stayed in the valley for most of their life. He moved to the areas where my grandpa was assigned, so Laredo, McAllen, Eagle Pass, Falcon Lake. He grew up with small towns and a lot of free time for adventures. The UFO. This story takes place truly in the middle of nowhere in the mid-1970s, when my dad was about 11 or 12. The way my dad described where it happened was by Alpine, kind of close to Derlingua, which is funny, because those towns are like 80 miles apart. If you get a map of Texas though, and look below Marfa and Alpine, and a little bit above Big Bend National Park, you'll see a vast expanse of nothing, which is hundreds of thousands of acres of private ranch lands and just general Texas nothingness. My dad was with his uncle and his cousins, who had a property deep in the middle of nowhere, and they were going to stay for a few days at said property. It was accessible by traveling over 40 miles of dirt road, and this meant over 2 hours of slow, bumpy riding. The day was hot, but beautiful. Not a single cloud in the sky. When they finally got to the small property, they started to unpack the truck and put their belongings inside. My dad's uncle said that they had to climb a hill to get to a well so they could gather water. So they all climbed the hill to where the well was located with their buckets and canteens. My dad was fooling around waiting for his turn, and kicking some rocks around. That's when one of his cousins pointed at the sky. There was a small cloud in the sky, and it was the only cloud in the sky. He said it was small, gray, and very round. Almost a perfect sphere. Everyone stopped what they were doing to watch it. It slowly got smaller and smaller, and then finally disappeared. They thought it had evaporated, and thought it was a cool little weather phenomenon. When my dad took his turn at the well, his cousin shouted that it was back. My dad turned around, and sure enough, it was. It was in the same exact spot and was static in position. But once again, it grew smaller and smaller, then disappeared. Then it would reappear. They watched this go on for about 15 minutes. My dad, being as young as he was, thought it was some kind of alien spaceship. His uncle was watching it through his binoculars and handed them to my dad to see. My dad said it didn't look like a cloud, but like a swirling cloud of smoke. It would shrink into itself, then reappear out of thin air. He said he was struck with fear and felt the urge to lay down. He was trembling and didn't know why he felt so nauseous and frightened. His uncle ushered everyone off the hill and back down to the cabin. He felt better after a few minutes, and nothing else like it happened over the weekend. I asked him when I was at his house if maybe it was a smoke cloud or smoke signal, but he explained how there was no column of smoke connected to it and it was too high up to be dust or anything else. They also couldn't figure out why it was just stuck in the sky, in that one spot, shrinking into itself and then reappearing, like a creepy pulsing dance. He went back out there a couple times after that, but never experienced anything remotely like that again. There's plenty of stories about that area. The Marfa lights have been debunked, but there are other mysterious happenings that come out of Big Bend, and between Highway 67 and 118. My goal is to one day go out there and see if I can experience these things myself. The canyon. Okay, so I completely forgot about this story until my dad told it last night. This has to be my all-time favorite off-the-trail scary story that is 100% true. I had to take down notes as my dad was speaking as there are a lot of details. In around 1989 or so, my dad was enrolled at the University of Texas in Austin. He was focusing on art and graphic design at the time. His professor, a very talented artist by the name of Bill Wyman, pronounced Wyman but not the Rolling Stones bassist, was my dad's watercolor professor at that time. My dad always lauded him for his amazing skills, and Bill did the same for my dad. Both are great artists and encouraged each other and learned a lot from their time together. One day when my dad was in his class, he noticed a glass printed black and white photo of a canyon. The photo was incredible. In the scene, half of the canyon was on a beautiful summerscape, with clear skies, clouds and sun. In the second half, there were dark clouds, rain and even snow. My dad was taken aback. He had never seen such an amazing photograph with this type of double exposure. He asks Bill about it, who puts his brush down and a very serious face washes over him. "That picture right there?" Bill says. "That's not edited. I took that picture exactly as I saw it. It's not mixed media, and there is no trickery." He wiped his hands on his apron. "There's a story behind it, too." He gestured for my dad to take a seat so he could regale the story of the picture to him. "I was never a religious man, but when I went to that canyon, I think I met something there that wanted me to change my mind. My dad was sucked in just as I was when I first heard this story. So the date of when this took place is unknown. From my own research and from talking with my dad, it would have taken place anywhere from 1966, when he was teaching at East Texas University, to the mid-1970s to 80s, when he was teaching at University of Texas in Austin. Either way, Bill had a contact from a Navajo reservation somewhere in New Mexico who had access to a canyon that contained old petroglyphs that have never been shown to the public. Bill met up with the contact and two other men in town for a bite to eat and to discuss what they were going to do and where they were going. They didn't offer much details about the petroglyphs other than to not touch them under any circumstances. He was an art professor and of course respected all forms of historical and ancient art. There was no way he was going to touch anything, but he promised anyway. They left in their Jeep and headed towards the canyon. It was a gorgeous day. Blue sky and sun with the perfect mix of minimal cloud cover and 80 degree weather. They drove for a long time on an empty highway until they pulled off into a dirt drive, where they had to pass through a gate. Bill's contact locked the gate behind him and they were soon off again down this small desert road. They got to the canyon entrance and it was gorgeous. Bill was perplexed, however, when they handed him a jacket and a hat. As they drove on down into the canyon, the sky got darker and the air got colder. They got to another gate that was in the middle of the canyon, but was also covered in barbed wire. They passed through and immediately the atmosphere felt charged with a feeling of energy, almost like static electricity. All the hair on his body stood up. The sky got darker still and it began to rain. Bill was bewildered at the sudden change of weather. It got colder the further they got into the canyon, until finally the rain turned to snow. Bill became anxious, but none of his questions were answered by the other three men. The snow came down harder, and soon enough they could barely see 5 feet in front of them. They came to a stop and told Bill that they would have to walk the rest of the way there. They trudged through the snow for about 30 minutes. Although it was a light blanket on the ground, there was still very little visibility in front of them. Finally, they came to the rock face, which stood under a natural canopy in the rock which shielded them from the snow. On this rock face were the most incredible petroglyphs Bill had seen in his life. They were well preserved and looked as though the artist had just walked away. However, there was one that Bill couldn't take his eyes away from. He said it was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. The man who knew about this place told Bill that it was a symbol of evil, and it was a sign of a curse. They said that they had to leave very soon. Bill kept looking at this symbol, entranced. He felt a sense of calm wash over him. He felt his hand reach out towards it. He turned to face the other men, but they had already started to walk back. He faced the symbol again and noticed his hand was almost about to touch it. At that very moment, he felt an overwhelming pressure, and the feeling of dread overtook him. He whipped his hand back. He turned back towards the men and they were barely three little black specks in the distance. He sprinted towards them like his life depended on it. They got back to the Jeep and clambered in, then quickly drove off in silence. Just like how they came in, the weather changed as they progressed out of the canyon. He took the picture as they were leaving, which illustrated the stark contrast in the weather there. The feeling of dread never left him, even after he got back, but eventually faded after a few years. However, his opinions on spirituality changed and he truly believed that whatever was there was trying to let him know that there's something else out there that live among us that we cannot explain. He made correspondence a few more times with his New Mexico friend, but was never invited back, nor was ever given any details about the symbol or the insane weather phenomenon they experienced. I've tried to find the picture. According to my dad and to Bill Wyman, who I believe has since passed on, it was a very real photo, and as far as I know, has been archived by the Smithsonian Archives of American Art. It's out there somewhere but just needs to be found. Bonus story, Ski Lodge ghost story. As an added bonus, I decided to include one of my favorites from my dad. It's not off the trail, but it's decently short and comes from our old doctor. So our doctor, I'll call him David, who is now a close family friend, decided to go up to Colorado to ski with his college buddies. There were about four of them in a nice ski lodge. As they were picking out rooms, David walked into one and said he instantly got the heebie-jeebies. "I'm not sleeping in here. Someone else can have it," and proceeded to take the room across the hall. His friend took the room instead. He felt as though it was off-putting, but shrugged it off and slept there anyway. After a long day of skiing, they arrived back to their lodge, exhausted and ready for sleep before the next day of activities. David fell asleep first, and soon enough everyone was out. In the middle of the night, David was awoken by his buddy in the room across from him, calling out, "David? David? You awake, man?" He responds, "Yeah, I'm awake. What's the matter? What do you need?" His buddy just replied with, "Never mind, man. Just checking." After minutes of silent confusion, he drifts back off to sleep. In the morning, the four dudes talk over breakfast about the day's plans. During a moment of silence, David's buddy asked if anybody came into his room that night. Everyone shook their heads no. David asked, "I remember you calling my name in the middle of the night. What was that about?" His buddy just looks at him and replies, "Someone was standing in the doorway of my bathroom, but when I called for you and you answered across the hall, I knew it wasn't you. When I looked back in the doorway, the figure was gone." The group was thoroughly creeped out and decided to clear the house for possible intruders. They came up empty-handed. David's buddy slept on the couch for the remainder of the trip. When he got back to Texas, David researched the lodge and found that a skier killed themselves in the bathroom of the very same creepy room that he had refused to sleep in. Came here hoping someone could share similar experiences or provide insight. I took a trip to stay in a cabin in the middle of the woods high up in the mountains of the city of Ranger, Georgia, USA. This neighborhood was 30 minutes up in the mountains away from civilization, and even the cabins were spread far apart. The front deck of the cabin was completely exposed to the woods, so I acknowledged that any animals could stroll along if they pleased. I stayed there for about a week, and my boyfriend and I sat outside on the front deck every night, very late, and at no point felt in danger. It was peaceful, with fireflies out and the sounds of crickets every night. Until the fifth night. It was eerily dark, too, the moon was heavily covered. It was about midnight, and all of a sudden, I didn't feel peace like I did those other nights. The forest went completely quiet, and I felt a horrible sense of dread. I genuinely feared for my life. I sat there in my chair, looking out into the dark forest, trying to rationalize and calm myself down, thinking it was my mind playing tricks. But then my boyfriend said out loud that he felt unsafe. I told him I felt the same, and we ran inside. The cabin has three floors, and we were able to climb out the window and sit on the roof because we wanted to still be outside and relax. But no matter how high up I was, I felt something truly evil and stayed inside. The only other time I felt something so evil or like someone was watching was when I had a few paranormal experiences at a haunted house. Georgia doesn't really get mountain lions. Maybe a bear, but it didn't feel that way at all. Edit, holy crap, I just remembered something about that night. I remember hearing a blood-curdling scream, and we pulled out a flashlight. Turns out it was a gray fox, and they make scary screaming sounds. The weird part was that the fox was running and had its ears and tail down. This was in June, and I just read that foxes scream like that when it's mating season or if they're in danger. Their mating season is winter or spring, so that was also afraid of something. This happened to me and a group of friends during the summer of 2019. I'm not a great writer, and my memory of the events might be hazy, so I don't know if I can do this story justice because it was actually pretty terrifying for me, at least. Also, I don't know if this is even paranormal, but I've never had an experience like this before in my life, and it's made me reconsider what I think when I hear other people's experiences and stories, as I never used to believe. Last year, I started hanging out with a few friends I went to high school with, playing Smash, eating pizza, and the like. We usually would get together around 10:30 p.m., as most of us work during the day because we don't have classes during the summer. One night, we decided to go to the nearby park, probably around midnight, to run around and whatnot, as teenagers do. They told me that sometimes they would see what they thought was a homeless guy hanging around the park or in the woods around the park, but they never got too close to him. They would jokingly refer to him as the sludge walker because that's the sound the wet ground would make when walking around in the park at night. The first time I go with two other people, I'll call them Mark and John. Mark is my close friend, who I've known for a long time, and the only one I was really familiar with in this group. He knows I'm kind of afraid of the dark and jokes about how creepy the sludge walker is. At this
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
At this point, I have no reason to be afraid, so I laugh it off as him screwing with me. We get to the park and sit at the pavilion, run around the soccer fields, talk shit, etc. Eventually, we run around the woods and meet back at the pavilion. After a couple of minutes, Mark flips and tells us to start running. We do so, thinking the cops are coming, as they sometimes patrol the park at night. When we are out of the park, Mark says he saw something coming out of the woods, and it looked like a really tall dude. I call BS and think he's just screwing with me and trying to give us a cool story to tell the rest of the friends in that group. Fast forward a few weeks or so. They convince me to go back to the park. This time, we intend to look for the sludge walker and see who or what it is. This time there are four of us, and we split into two groups. We decide to go Mark and John, Paul and I. Paul was like me in that neither of us used to believe in the paranormal or cryptids or anything like that. We are walking onto a path in the woods that surrounds the park, and we hear a few twigs snap. I say that it's probably deer or some shit, and we continue on. All of a sudden, something drops down from the tree canopy and scares the shit out of us. It was a bat, go figure. But as we continue into the woods farther, Paul stops me and says to listen. We hear some leaves rustling behind us, and I reach to get my flashlight out. I don't see what's in front of us, but Paul does. As I'm fumbling with my phone trying to get the flashlight, Paul hits the deck, so I do as well. Then we hear something running up the path away from us. The footsteps were fast and sounded very heavy. I am freaking out at this point because I thought we were going to get mugged by some guy who was catching some Z's in the woods. It doesn't come back, and we call the other group of people and hightail it out of the park. Paul says he saw the thing, and it looked really tall with a hunched back and really long fingers. Again, I call BS because that's every scary monster troop mixed into one, and I brush it off as a homeless guy again. A few days later, and we're all hanging out again. They say we should go back into the woods and check it out again. I disagree because I don't want to come across a homeless guy again. Again, I give in to peer pressure and my own curiosity and end up going with them. This time we all stick together and are making our way through the woods, and we hear it. As if from every creature horror movie you've ever seen, everything is dead silent when suddenly, this screeching erupts from the path behind us, and we all book it as fast as we can out into the open. We are all freaked out, but Mark and John decide to run back into the woods and get a recording of this thing. They took a video, even though it was dark and you can't see anything. I am freaked out, and none of us can figure out what this is. My sister hypothesized that it could be a fox screaming, as they make a sound kind of like that, but we think this sound is polyphonic, two pitches at once, so we're all stumped. You know the drill by now. Mark, John, and I are hanging out again, and it's raining. I want to go back this time as I want to get to the bottom of this. Finally, the rain lets up at about 3 a.m., and we suit up for a muddy trek and head out. Probably the worst mistake I could make, as what happened next I still can't wrap my head around, and I still can't sleep in complete darkness. We're in the park, and almost immediately, we see someone very tall walking out from under the pavilion. Here it's coming right at us as the light from the pavilion illuminates the figure walking at us. We run behind some tall bushes as I speculate it could be a cop or park ranger coming to bust us for trespassing. We decide to take a peek and creep along the edge of these tall bushes. When we round the corner, we see it, standing fully upright just a few feet in front of us. I didn't really get a good look at it, but I saw really long fingers, and some sort of cloth draped across its body, and it was at least 7 feet tall. We all start running, and me being a total wuss, start actually screaming. I don't think I've ever run faster in my entire life. I looked back a few times to see if it was following us, and it was just walking along the bush line. I also noticed that it had multiple glowing eyes that were glowing a faint red color, which was the only way I could tell where it was. My adrenaline was going so hard I couldn't tell if it was making noise or not. I've never gone back, and I don't intend to. I sometimes think that it was a homeless guy or someone who lives by the park screwing with us because I don't really believe in the paranormal, but this is something I really can't explain any other way. Mark theorized that it could be a skinwalker or a wendigo from urban legends. When I do tell people about this, I usually leave out the part about the glowing eyes as it just sounds stupid and crazy, but that's the part that keeps me from believing that it's just some guy. Everyone wants to have a weird or paranormal experience, but when you actually do, it sticks with you and can really mess with your head in the long term. And in my case makes a 20-year-old sleep with a nightlight. If you actually read this and you have any questions, feel free to ask in the comments. This is my first Reddit post, so I'll do my best to get back to you. I'll try to keep this brief, although it's a lot of information. But these are my experiences from a case I've been working on in my role as a chaplain and demonologist for the Order of St. John. If you're a skeptic, this won't convince you. Also, I'm not embellishing details very well, so feel free to ask. I'm just tired from work. Before my visit, I was given a referral by our regional chaplain, who's responsible for ministry and chaplaincy support within a large city area. Chaplains are community-placed roles, whereas pastors and ministers work in churches, and typically priests work in an abbey or monastery, in our denomination, at least. I used to be a pastor, but I'm now a chaplain in the community. I'm an area chaplain, responsible for a handful of suburbs and any of the Order of St. John staff who work or live in these suburbs. The referral I received was from within my area. I needed to go and check out a forest that someone had reported creepy goings on, which included strange noises, feelings of being watched, and strange signs. The community member also reported that they always had nightmares and bad sleep after visiting the forest but didn't put this together for a little while. It's a nice forest, small, on the edge of suburbia. It's secluded, so it's great for walking dogs. So naturally, I took my dog, and I also always take a blessed Teo with me. First visit. On my first visit, I found some strange things and heard some strange things. I found a bird with a broken neck next to a bag of rotting meat, opposite a small candle shrine in the forest. To me, this was a clear indicator of something human going on, although my job is to try and disprove the paranormal. But I have to admit, this immediately put me in the concerned camp. I continued to walk and found two more dead animals. One was a native eel that had its head cleanly cut off, and the other was a dead hedgehog that had sadly been bludgeoned to the point it was flat. My first assumptions were psychotic teens, homeless person, or attempted dark magic. There were also strange markings painted on the trees and on the path. I also noted that there were no wildlife noises present, but we are in a change of seasons, so pressure drops are common at the moment. However, I performed a blessing, which includes singing, and the birds were singing by the time I finished. I took the rotting meat and threw it in the bin. Second visit. For this visit, I came back armed with a Bible, a small wooden cross, and my uniform. Blessings are often not a one-and-done resolution. You need to bless something multiple times. Blessings are one of our most misunderstood tools. They're a security blanket, not a conflict resolution. This visit is when things sank in for me. I found large drag marks around the forest, many of which ended at the small shrine area where I had found the dead bird. This visit is also when I started to hear murmuring in the forest, barely audible. I also started to experience large movement around me, with one inexplicable movement in a shallow stream. The stream is about 15 centimeters deep, but something splashed in it sent the water about a meter into the air. It was just strange. I also felt pressure on the back of my neck and back ribs, but this could have been anxiety-driven muscle tension. I walked through the forest, with my cross drawn, and prayed a small exorcism invocation whenever it felt appropriate, just to be safe. Third visit. This was the hardest one. When I arrived, the whole forest smelled horribly of death because of all the dead animals. I assume there are some I missed, but I certainly found more. A decapitated rat, birds, some mice. This time I had brought my prayer book of St. Martin to consecrate the area. When I entered the forest, it sounded as though people were using the track, so I kept the dog on a lead. However, I never found anyone. The talking always seemed to be around a corner and just indistinguishable. When I began the prayer, I immediately started to vomit uncontrollably, and the sickly sweet smell of death became unbearable. But I pushed through. I also constantly heard the movement of something large in the forest. I kept praying and vomiting until I finished the consecration, and the vomiting stopped. The smell of death also disappeared. I did the prayer again to be safe and did not vomit this time. Fourth and most recent visit. I returned, and the animals are either gone or decomposed, and the smell has completely gone. There were still strange noises and movements within the forest and water. We don't have large wildlife here, so the noises are strange, to say the least. But other than that, things seemed to be coming right. I still felt stalked and still heard murmuring, but the activity absolutely seems to have lessened. I need to go back and pick up all the rubbish that has accumulated, bless it again, and fix the markings. Wish me luck. This was around 2006. I had just graduated from a small liberal arts school in New York City with a degree in writing and, like most new graduates, figured I'd be running shit in no time. I'd been mostly going on interviews for assistant positions and the like, so when I applied to an ad for a copywriter and got an interview, I jumped at the chance. This was 2006 when Craigslist was still a viable job search option instead of a backdoor prostitution cesspool with the occasional nice couch. So I was using it almost exclusively for job hunting. The interview was in a pretty nondescript building in Chelsea. If you're familiar with the city, it was one of those narrow pre-wars around 7th Avenue that are usually filled with low-budge modeling agencies and startup production companies. Of course, I didn't have any of that context at the time and still thought my 3-month internship would be my ticket to career success. So yeah. Anyhow, I go up to the floor as instructed in the email. The company is called, fake name that's similar, The Dirty Glass, more on this to come. It's one of these gift catalog deals with housewares and tabletop which seemed fun and mostly stress-free. Was still a pot-smoking hippie at that point and was looking for an easy, laid-back gig. Counter, I know, with my thinking I was hot shit, but I was young and contradicted myself a lot back then. One other note, as part of my application, I'd been asked to answer 3 questions about myself in the same sultry scandalous style I'd planned to use in the catalog and send along a picture. I didn't really think anything of this, since the catalog had a particular tone that was sort of a little naughty, not like NSFW prawn naughty, more like OMA mom drinking wine before noon naughty, and didn't realize a picture wasn't part of the standard application process. So I make my way to office. Now on the office door someone has taped a piece of computer paper printed with the name of the company. Odd, I think, until I remember that the hiring manager told me they'd recently moved. At this point, I'm just eager to prove myself to this company and fantasizing about how jealous all my former classmates will be at my fancy new title when door swings open. On the other side, the man who greets me is distinctly gay. No judgment, I'm a gay woman, but suffice it to say my gaydar was buzzing like crazy. This actually puts me at ease. Great, I think. Now I don't have to posture to some douchebag who wants a young secretary to ogle during business hours. This is really about me and my talent. As he greets me in the doorway, I peek behind the man and see another girl already sitting inside with her purse. The guy, we'll call him S, tells me he's just finishing up another interview and invites me in. Again, I'm not thinking this is too weird, mostly because it's a small office, just a single room, I soon find out, but also because I have little to no experience interviewing. So I sit down next to this girl. Right away, I notice a wine glass on the table. S immediately offers me a glass of wine, mind you, it's 11:30 or so in the morning, and tells me this is not your typical office environment, that people are free to drink, have fun and avoid the typical corporate grind. Again, that alarm bell inside me threatens to ring, but as I said, I'm a little bit of a free spirit, and certainly was back then, so I push it away and, being 22, jump at the chance to drink in the middle of the day. S quickly rushes through a bunch of standard interview questions with this girl and then turns to both of us. Now he's super animated all of a sudden, explaining how the Dirty Glass website is just the tip of the iceberg as far as what he's trying to create with his company. Now this is 10 years ago plus at this point, but I will try to recount exactly what he told me. Basically he says the Dirty Glass catalog will soon be divided into 3 sections. Section 1 will be the alcohol and barware section of the site, Section 2 will be devoted to food. Section 3, he tells us, leaning in, is of the utmost secrecy and we're lucky enough to get a preview. Basically, what S is trying to create is a hedonist community where VIP members get access to a black card that gives them special privileges all over the world to eat at the best restaurants, drink the best wine and join in on hedonist activities wherever they can be found. Section 3 of the site is therefore devoted to sex toys of all stripes, to be consistent with the hedonist aspect of his offline secret society. Writers will be required to try all the products in their section in order to write authentic descriptions. How awesome is that, I think, when we're still talking about wine and food, so if you're involved in Section 3, you have to be sexually adventurous. Now, let me recap. I'm a naive 22-year-old sitting next to another 20-something drinking wine in the middle of the day with a stranger who's pitching me his hedonist fever dream. Why I did not run out of there I will never know. For some odd reason, I think largely because I had just spent the past 4 years reading existentialist philosophy and smoking pot, I'm actually entertaining all this as a viable business model. The other girl, for her part, also seems super on board with the idea. So S continues. As far as the job goes, there's a couple different ways writers can be involved. The first is as a contributor who submits every once in a while. The second is as a staff writer, stationed at the office HQ who gets paid a salary to write for the catalog, and the third is someone with company stakes who is as much of a partner as he is. S has names for these levels, as he calls them, two of which have now faded from memory, but one I will never forget. The deepest level, as he says, is the inner sinner circle. The inner sinner circle, he tells us, are those who will write for this third layer of his site, the hedonist side. He describes this group as being like a bunch of sex columnists required to use the products they discuss, with one small catch. They're required to use them in front of each other, in the office. I turn to the girl next to me who is effusively expressing her interest in of all this. Again, more on that later. Wow, I think. I have some competition here. I know, don't even say it. So naive. So S goes back into professional mode, concludes the interview with the other girl, shuts the door and turns to me. Now it's just the two of us in this tiny room in the middle of this random pseudo-office building in Chelsea. Immediately, he's animated again and tells me, as great as the other girl seemed, he just knows I'm the perfect person for this job. He wants me to go all the way with him. Every level. At this point, my internal alarm, which has been ringing in a vacuum somewhere, finally reaches my ears. What do you mean? I ask. I want you to be in the inner sinner circle. Would you be interested in that, Rusevich? Even at this point, I'm still on board with his weird social experiment, and I tell him sure, I would potentially be interested, all the while knowing I've got to get out of here because even if this is a legitimate opportunity, things are getting weird. Great, he tells me. In order to be part of the inner sinner circle and for him to trust that I'm ready for it, he just requires one thing. He wants me to masturbate in front of him. Right now. Okay, now I know I gotta get the F out of this place. So, very calmly, while still matching his general level of excitement, I tell him that as pumped as I am about the opportunity, this is not something my girlfriend would be comfortable with me doing. In response, and matching my calmness measure for measure, he makes me call my girlfriend to ask her permission. Now I'm on the phone with her, frantically trying to explain his whole movement, telling her this guy wants me to masturbate in front of him. Thankfully, she's my ex now, cause she barely reacts with more than a "that's weird" when I tell her, and all the while he's watching me, refilling my wine glass, waiting for my decision. So I get off the phone and tell him nope, I'm sorry, she says I can't do it. But still he urges me on, more pleading. More insistent. Now, I will never understand how I did this, but miraculously I am able to convince him that I seriously plan to email him a nude of myself at a later date. I obviously had no intention of actually sending one, and with him still thinking I was interested in being an inner sinner, got the hell out of there. Looking back, I don't know why I didn't pick up more on the signs that so much was wrong with this situation. I now believe the girl before me was an obvious plant. I'm convinced he'd put something in my wine. He had a fridge with two different bottles he was pouring from, and that had I drank more, who knows if I'd have made it out of there the same as I came in. It took me until months later, when I was recounting the story to a professor friend, to really realize just how serious things could have gotten. I even wrote to S the next day to politely decline the position, with an earnest hope that he keep pursuing his big dream, so convinced as I was that what he was starting was really different and unique. Months later, I saw the ad I answered pop up again on Craigslist and flagged it, but nothing really came of it, and the Dirty Glass site remained up for a long time. I seriously hope no other young writers found out what was really going on in the inner sinner circle. So, rapey man from my first job interview, let's never, never meet again. I had to live in the Bay Area for a couple months so I could be on site at a new contract. I had never been in the area before, so I assumed that a place in San Jose would be an okay commute to Mountain View, which was great because I found a room in a 5-bedroom house that was cheap and close enough to the train station to get away with a bike. Sent them a few emails and sorted it all out. Showed up at SFO a week later, rented a car for the first week and drove down and found the house. The house is a cute little bungalow on a residential street. Yep, the house on one side had a terrified retired couple living in it. The house on the other, I never saw a soul. There was barbed wire on a lot of the fences, lots of locks on the doors. Friday nights was cruise down the main street and blare music out of your pickups while possibly blasting your handguns in the air for some reason. The other people in the house were all working for the main leaseholders who were the regional sellers for a national television provider. Nice enough people, but there wasn't much highbrow conversations to be had. One of the guys was technically supposed to be in Fresno because of a minor bit of bother with the local police and was in constant violation of his parole. His friends would come by and they'd while away the evening hours drinking and smoking and having a whale of a time. The Wi-Fi stopped working at one point, and was mentioned in the original Craigslist ad, so I asked what was up. I got I guess the neighbor changed their password finally. Sigh. One of the guys actually drove me to the train station on the last day. The former drug dealer had some interesting stories. The Mexican food was excellent. Maybe this wasn't such a bad Craigslist experience after all. Not me, but it happened to my brother. He was selling a gun on Craigslist, I know, mistake number one. And he decided to meet the potential buyer at a public place by himself, strike two. All seemed normal until my brother looked down at his phone to respond to a text. The scumbag buyer then proceeds to taser my brother. My brother reaches for his personal gun on his holster and tries to shoot him, but grazes him and ends up shooting his own truck. Worse things could have happened, so I'm glad my brother is alive. He learned a valuable lesson. And at the very least, I can say someone tasered my bro. I got my daughter her first car a long time ago when she was 18 years old, and she felt very nervous about learning to drive. Luckily, after many lessons and stressful times, we helped her become a really good driver. She became proficient enough to pass her driving test and drive safely on her own without me having to sit next to her and help her all the time. Later, she went to a faraway university and planned to buy her own car there. The university was about 20 or 30 miles from our home. Compared to other students, it wasn't too far from home, but it was too long of a distance for her to travel every day. So, my daughter decided she would visit home once a week and mentioned she was considering buying a different car near her university. This left me with the task of selling her car. I thought the best way was to use Craigslist, so I listed the car for sale there. The car was a 2010 Citroen, which isn't very common in the United States. Citroen cars are more often seen in Europe and the UK, but we had this one. I originally paid around $2,000 for it, so I put it up for sale at $1,000, as it wasn't a big deal for me. Eventually, a few people showed interest and wanted to come see the car. They seemed interested and each had their reasons for liking it and wanting to buy it from me. I always felt a bit unsure about people coming over to our house to look at things, but I didn't have any other way to sell the car unless I wanted to go to a local dealer who might have given me only $10 for it. So, I decided to let people come and see the car, as there wasn't much choice. After that, I thought I could give my daughter the money from selling the car so that she could use it for the new car she wanted to buy, as she had passed her driving test and was going to university. I thought this was a good plan, even though I had bought the car for her. I wanted her to have the money to help her get the next car she wanted. Eventually, I set upon a man. His title on Craigslist was Paul, and he intended to buy this car. In a similar situation that I did, Paul told me that his daughter was learning to drive and was about 16 or 17 years old. She wanted a simple car that had manual transmission, which is also called stick shift. Most people these days are learning to drive in automatic cars, but Paul really wanted his daughter to learn with manual transmission. After a few days of chatting back and forth, we started talking more. Paul asked about the car's history, the maintenance it had, and all the repairs it had undergone. He seemed to know a lot about cars and was knowledgeable when it came to how cars work and their mechanics. On my side, I haven't really been into that stuff throughout my life. I was fine with letting mechanics handle things and taking the car to the garage for checkups. It doesn't mean I ignored the cars, I made sure to keep up with maintenance and servicing. I just didn't have interest in the technical side or how things work. On the other hand, this guy seemed like a real mechanical nerd. He was asking me things that I couldn't even understand. At one point, I had to search online to figure out what some of the terms he used meant. It was becoming a bit overwhelming, so I simply asked him to come over and see the car. Eventually, he came over to check out the car as we agreed on a Friday evening when he finished his work and came with his daughter. When Friday night came, I was eager to sell the car, as it was just sitting in our driveway, making things look crowded. Our driveway already had four cars, and adding a fifth one meant we had to keep moving them around, since we live with four or sometimes five people until my daughter left. But that's a different story that I'll talk about later. After waiting for a while, the man comes over. My wife is excited for me to sell the car and give the money to our daughter. The man starts eyeing the car up and down and immediately asks to look inside the bonnet. When he opens the front bonnet, he starts poking around and shining a torch all around the parts of the engine. So there he was, leaning over with his head almost inside the car, shining a light on different parts. I was there next to his daughter, both of us with our arms crossed, feeling a bit clueless. We stood there, waiting, while this so-called expert inspected every little part of the car. I wasn't going to sell the car if it was about to break down or if something wasn't right, but this guy seemed really suspicious about that. Even though I had put the price at just over $1,000, which is much lower than what the car was actually worth, despite all of this, after looking at the engine for about 3 or 4 minutes, he finally turns to me and asks for a test drive. In simple words, he wanted to drive the car with me in the passenger seat, and his daughter would sit in the back. I thought that was fine and agreed, so we both put on our seat belts, and off we went down the road. This is where things got interesting, and I started to wonder what exactly this guy was up to with the car. Then, the guy starts pressing the gas pedal really hard and suddenly slams on the brakes in the middle of the road. We were in a quiet neighborhood, and there were no cars in front or behind us. I don't know exactly what he has tried to prove, as I had already given him all the info about the car's maintenance history. I explained why and how we bought the car, even what type of gas we used and the servicing we did. I thought that should be enough, but no, he was testing the car like he was a professional race driver. It was as if he wanted his daughter to race on a track with it, but still, I tried to ignore what he was doing. We sat there awkwardly while he kept slamming on the brakes, pushing the gas, and sometimes even making the car stop suddenly and start again. Now the car made really bad sounds, like something was wrong with the gears, and it seemed like he was almost breaking it. To break the awkward silence in the car, I looked at him and said, "So, what do you think?" He turned to me and asked more questions about the car as we pulled over to the side of the road near the sidewalk. But he let the engine run while keeping the clutch up. I started asking him more questions about why he was doing all these tests. He said he was checking if the car was really reliable and if there were any problems with it. On the other end, his daughter hadn't said anything the whole time and stayed quiet, almost like he was the one in charge and she didn't have any say in what was happening. Just when he's almost sure that he wants to buy the car, we start turning around to go back to my house and finish the deal. But suddenly, the car stops working. When the car stops, there's a really awkward silence for about 2 seconds. He doesn't say anything, he just looks down at the steering wheel. I'm looking at him, feeling really awkward and not sure what's going on. He tries to start the car again, but it won't start. He's getting more and more frustrated, and I couldn't understand why he was so upset. He looks at me as if it was somehow a setup and I was trying to scam him. He keeps trying to start the car, but it's not working. At that moment, a warning light for the battery being low comes on. Instead of taking that as a sign, he turns to me and starts blaming me. In his mind, he somehow believes that I was trying to cheat him by selling a broken car for $1,000. After everything we just experienced, he doesn't seem to realize that the way he was driving the car just moments ago, pushing the gas hard, then braking abruptly might have contributed to the issue. All this even though we had just started the car and driven out of my driveway seconds earlier. I felt pretty puzzled by what happened next because it's like something changed in his mind instantly. At first, he was this odd and sort of nerdy guy carefully examining the engine like a detective, and suddenly he switched to thinking I was trying to cheat him out of $1,000 because the car stopped due to battery problems. I tried to be honest with him, as I didn't know what was wrong, and I certainly didn't plan this. I attempted to calm him down because he was now really angry and started using bad words and told his daughter to leave the car. I remember they walked back to their truck, marching together in a hurry, holding hands. I felt really terrible, as if he believed I was trying to trick them. I didn't understand why he reacted that way, but after this incident, I took the car to my local dealership, and they told me it was just a battery problem. They said the battery's charge was actually good, around 75%, so I didn't need to replace it. The guy had driven the car recklessly with the engine still cold, even though it was an old car. He acted foolishly and seemed to think he knew everything about cars, but anyone experienced in mechanics or engineering wouldn't start a car and then suddenly go full speed with their foot on the gas just seconds after starting it. I put the car up for sale on Craigslist again and found a good owner. It was a nice older lady, maybe in her mid-60s, who just needed a car for getting around. She came to check the car, everything was fixed, and the battery issue was gone. I took some extra drives to make sure the engine was okay after what had happened with the guy earlier. I sold the car and gave my daughter the extra $1,000. But that was definitely my worst and only bad experience on Craigslist.